Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A few weeks ago, a state prison employees poked a condemned man. It was Romel Broom, something like 18 times to find a suitable vein into which they hoped to inject a drug to paralyze him and otherwise render him unconscious before the lethal injection intended to honor the sentence that was handed down many years ago. Finally, they gave up and a judge gave the man a few more weeks to live to recover enough to again face death. This week, the parade of executions was supposed to begin again. Joining us in the studio today to refresh our memories on the use of lethal injection and to get us caught up to date on the latest is Andrew Welsh Huggins. He's an Associated Press reporter and also the author of No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States, and that would be Ohio. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Could you get us up to date on what happened with the Federal Appeals Court this morning?
So just this morning, a three-judge panel of the Sixth Circuit Appeals Court in Cincinnati ruled 2-1 to delay the execution of Lawrence Reynolds. Now, he was scheduled to be executed this coming Thursday at Lucasville for strangling his neighbor about 15 years ago. His attorneys had immediately – after the problems with the Broom execution that you referred to on September 15th, it was inevitable that his attorneys were going to raise that issue for him. And they argued the state is showing that it's not competent to carry out executions right now. If Broom is going to be delayed, then you need to allow this execution to be delayed until we get this worked out. The Ohio Supreme Court did not buy that argument and refused to delay the execution last week. But this panel just this morning, about an hour and a half ago, released their opinion. It was 2-1 in favor of delaying the execution and letting the district judge here in Columbus, Gregory Faust, let him include this as part of his hearing on the Broom case, which will take place in November.
And what's that hearing going to be about? What are they going to do there?
They're going to debate the merits of whether Romel Broom should be executed, period, give the state another bite at the apple, so to speak, or should he be allowed to serve out his life in prison? They'll get to the merits of the argument. Does one attempt, is that all you get? Is a second attempt unconstitutional?
Has the state ever done a second attempt before? This was unprecedented?
This is unprecedented. Certainly since Ohio resumed executions in 99, there's never been anything like this. And even going back in history, I'm not aware of a case where an inmate – where they couldn't execute him and they took him away for a few days, a few weeks and tried again. So this is not only unprecedented in Ohio, but listeners may know that the only other time this has ever really happened in the country was in 1946 in Louisiana. A 15-year-old boy, that's right, a 15-year-old boy was in the electric chair, and for some reason, something didn't go right. The electricity didn't take. He was pulled out of the chair. He spent the next year in a jail cell while his case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they ruled in 1947, 5-4, that the state of Louisiana could carry out a second attempt, in which they did, and Willie Francis was executed. That's the only precedent of this sort, and that's certainly – you're already seeing references to that case in the numerous court filings since the Broom attempt.
And references in arguments against Broom's attorneys?
Certainly arguments against, but also arguments for. I mean, the state can look at that ruling and say, well, the U.S. Supreme Court considered this very fact, and what they found is that a problem with a specific execution is not the same thing as a cruel and unusual process. In other words, the process, at least in those days, of electrocution was considered not to be cruel and unusual. Now, a problem with that could be a different story, but even in that case, they ruled that Willie Francis hadn't raised enough objections to save his life.
And now we're dealing with a problem with the form.
That's
execution,
right.
That they couldn't find a vein. And it's not the only time they've had problems. There was another fellow who was also a drug addict 7 years ago, wasn't there, that had the same problem, but they just kept at it?
That's right. Ohio has actually had four problems with executions. We forget that the very first inmate, Wilford Berry, that his execution was delayed about half an hour because they were having trouble accessing a vein. The case that most people refer to is Joseph Clark in 2006. Now, that's a case where he was on the gurney. The needles had been put in his arms. He had made his last statement. The flow of chemicals began. Something wasn't working right, and they got a pretty good idea when he pushed himself up on the gurney and said, "It don't work." And for, you know, another hour or so, they went back. They tried different things. They finally were able to access the correct veins and put him to death. Now, that was a serious problem. The state investigated. They took many incident reports. The next case after that was Christopher Newton in 2007. Now, the state will argue that was not a botched execution. That was an overweight inmate. It took them a while to find the veins. They found the veins. They put him to death. I will say that Joseph Clark did have problems in his veins because of drug use. Whether Rommel Broom was a drug user is up for debate.
Okay.
He says he and his family say he was not a hard drug user. The state says at one point he indicated he was. So that probably will be debated here in the future as well.
This is probably a quote unquote dumb question, but can't they kind of preview their veins before they're going to be actually executed? You know, bring them to the prison clinic and check them out and see what their veins are like so that they know. It seems as if they're completely taken by surprise that they can't find a vein.
Yeah, it's not a dumb question, and it's certainly going to be part of the litigation that goes forward. Now, apparently in some other states, there are situations where doctors will go to death row and on the pretense of just checking on the inmate's health, that in fact that's what they're doing, is trying to take a look at their veins. But there's nothing in Ohio protocols that requires them to do this check several weeks ahead of time. Certainly an inmate receives an execution date sometimes several months ahead of the actual date, so there's plenty of time for preparation. Typically what happens in Ohio is the inmate arrives in Lucasville a day before the execution, and at that point they start checking the veins. And in fact, that's what happened with Rommel Broom on the Monday, so the day before his execution. There's a note in a log that they checked his arms, and I believe they said there appeared to be that the left arm might be problematic. But that's about all the preparation they do.
When they talk about 18 attempts, are you telling me that they stuck a needle in him 18 times and couldn't get the vein that way? Is that what you're saying? Or was it just they kept looking?
No, I believe 18 sticks is – that's certainly what Rommel Broom has already testified to in court depositions.
Okay.
And apparently the problem is they could access the vein – but then the vein wasn't usable. It would not take the saline, or they were testing it just to see if it would work. And that, you know, it's a bit of a distinction there. But the state says it's not true. We couldn't access a vein. We accessed veins plenty of times. We couldn't find a usable vein. That does raise the question: if they couldn't find a usable vein, then on this particular individual, you know, what happens if they try again and they still can't find a usable vein?
In Ohio, and maybe it's this way everywhere, there are no – well, describe what the protocol is. Who has to be in that room and who is actually administering the lethal injections and the injections? And
it's a two-part process in Ohio. It begins not in what we think of as the death chamber, but it begins in the holding cell where the inmate has been for about the past 18 hours. An execution team comes in. Now, these are prison employees who volunteer for this duty. They are not paid to do this, although, you know, they're on the prison payroll for whatever their other job is. And typically one of them is a paramedic, and this has been debated
legally. Do they have to have a paramedic or not?
They don't have to, no. There's nothing that says they do, but they like that because the paramedics have the skills to do it. Now, a paramedic and other medical team members – there are no doctors or nurses involved here, by the way. They will, in this holding cell, typically with the inmate's cooperation, I'll say, will attempt to place a shunt in, just like, you know, if you've ever given blood or been in a hospital where you've had an IV put in your arm, it's a very similar process. You see the same types of antiseptic scrubs and that same purple stuff they put on arms. So that's where the so-called shunts are put in. Once that is done, then the inmate is escorted, almost always walks himself, into the death chamber, which is 17 steps from his holding cell. He's put down on a gurney, strapped down, whether he needs to or not, that's part of the protocol. Only one inmate in 32 times has struggled in Ohio. And then the intravenous tubes are hooked up at that point. The executioner, the person that we think of who's the person who actually, you know, pushes the button, or in this case pushes down the syringe, is in a room across from the inmate's feet. He can see the inmate. The inmate cannot see him. And it's that person who, at a signal from the warden, will begin injecting the chemicals that carry out the process. It's a three-drug process in Ohio. The first drug puts the inmates to sleep. And by the way, that's the same chemical that's used to put pets down. The second drug paralyzes the inmate. And the third drug stops the heart.
What's the purpose of paralysis?
Well, the purpose of paralysis, I guess, is to if I have this right, is to prevent serious pain. That first of all, the person is just knocked out, and then the paralysis is my understanding, I guess, is to keep them from feeling any pain once the heart is stopped. The way this is supposed to work is that the inmate feels no pain. Now, this has been the source of great legal debate.
We got to take a break right now, but I wanted to get back to that idea of feeling no pain. If you would like to join the conversation with Associated Press reporter and author Andrew Welsh Huggins, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Good morning from WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. 56 degrees under sunny skies in downtown Columbus at 11:18. Join WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer. WOSU's Fall Pledge Drive is coming up, and we need your help. Help to answer calls from WOSU listeners like you this month. For more information, including dates and times, visit wosu.org/volunteer. In the weather forecast for today, sunshine and a high of 65, clear skies tonight and a low of 45. Sunshine Tuesday morning, and then clouds move in Tuesday afternoon, bringing a chance of afternoon rain showers. A high of 72 for tomorrow. Tuesday night, rain is likely and a low of 55. Partly cloudy and windy on Wednesday with a high of 60 degrees. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. And now back to All Sides.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the lethal injection portion of the death penalty protocol and how it's changed and how it's changed us with author Andrew Welsh Huggins, who wrote about that and everything else to do with the death penalty in Ohio in No Winners Here, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides with Ann Fisher at allsides@wosu.org. Lawmakers took away the right to choose from condemned prisoners in Ohio. Why did they do that? Isn't choice part of maybe avoiding pain or what someone perceives as pain?
Well, I think you're referring to the end of the electric chair as an option in Ohio.
2005 or
2003 maybe, okay. But around that time. Actually, it was the prison department that pushed that. Reggie Wilkinson was the then director of the Department of Corrections, and he felt that particular process was would have been extremely tough on the prison staff. And, you know, death by electrocution it can be extremely problematic, and there are just numerous cases of executions by electric chair that did not go well. And I think even the most subjective person in terms of the death penalty, you would have to agree that at least in terms of how it appears, putting a person to death by injection is a lot less it's a lot less violent, for one thing, than putting a person to death in the electric chair. So I think that was the reasoning Plus, the idea of injection, it sort of has been slowly sweeping the nation. More and more states have turned to that. There's very few states now that don't have an alternative. Almost all states now carry out executions through injection. There's only a few that have the chair as an option, and I think only one or two where hanging is still actually – an inmate can still actually choose to be hung.
Utah? Is that still a state that allows it?
I'm thinking of Washington State actually. This came up a few years ago when an extremely obese inmate in Washington State wanted to be hanged. And, you know, to talk about the gruesomeness of this topic, one of the concerns was that he might be decapitated when the process was begun because he was so heavy.
Is there anywhere where they allow public execution?
No place in the United States. Most public executions in the United States began to end in the mid-1800s. That was the case in Ohio. And the last public execution in the United States was in Kentucky in 1936, I believe, when a man was hanged down there. And there are certainly all executions now are carried out in very small death chambers with very few witnesses.
We were talking earlier about this progression of or devolution or evolution of what we view as pain and about the idea that we don't want to cause the condemned any pain. And how did this come about? Because the idea of the death penalty is sort of the ultimate punishment, and a pin prick doesn't seem to be, or a needle poke doesn't seem to be anything compared to what's ahead. Tell me about why are we so averse to causing some pain?
Well, this has a long history. In the United States, hanging was the chief way people were executed for a couple hundred years. But interestingly, with the development of electricity and the advent of electricity, there were people, including Thomas Edison, who said, "Let's use this clean, modern, efficient technology to make the death penalty more humane." And that's why the death penalty – that's why the electric chair was actually developed. And Ohio had a couple of the first electric chair executions in the nation in the late 1890s. So the idea was we are not in the business as a society of inflicting cruelty and pain on these people we're putting to death. We're just putting them to death. That is their punishment. They broke the social contract as defined by our laws, and they're going to pay the ultimate price. But the idea was not to punish them with pain. The idea was simply to put them to death. So then the question became, how do we do that in the most efficient and humane fashion? We did hangings, and then we moved to the electric chair. And of course, you'll recall that a transition period was, well, we'll use cyanide gas, that's not as violent.
That.
Well, they found out that cyanide gas is very problematic. For one thing, it's extremely dangerous, obviously not just to the inmate but to the people involved in the process, and you have to be extremely careful with it. And I think that's where the idea of injection developed. Now, here's a process where we can we've hit maximum efficiency. It puts the inmates to death with the least amount of violence, and also is arguably the has the least effect on the staff carrying it out. Whereas if you think about it, watching someone be electrocuted, you know, burned to death in some cases is pretty traumatic.
Why don't they require a medical personnel to be present, someone who's trained to do specifically this sort of a job?
Well, I suppose they could require that and they could put it into state law, but you'd run smack into the medical association's policies. The Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. The American Medical Association has pretty strict rules prohibiting its members from participating in executions, the same with the National Nurses Association. And so, you could require that. My guess is you certainly wouldn't get any doctors, at least in Ohio, who would participate. That said, at the end of every execution in Ohio, the Scioto County coroner steps into the death chamber and declares that person dead. I guess at that point, there's a body in his county that he has to account for.
And he's usually been standing by. He or she has been standing by. And
that's right. Yeah, they're there, and one of the more sort of gruesome aspects of witnessing an execution is when you walk towards the death chamber, inevitably you on your right you pass the hearse waiting to take the body away.
How many executions have you witnessed, Andrew?
I've witnessed four. The most recent was Jason Getze, who was a Trumbull County defendant who was sentenced to die for a murder-for-hire case.
I'm speaking with Andrew Walsh Huggins. He is the author of a book about the death penalty in Ohio. It's called No Winners Here, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Let's take a call. Lori, you want to talk about the experience of being poked with a needle. Lori, you're on the air.
Oh, well, the first thing I'd like to say is I'm not sure whether he's pro or con the death penalty. But, you know, the first thing I'd like to say is obviously it's something that one cannot practice. So therefore, it's not very likely that one can become proficient in administering the death penalty.
Why do you say that, Lori? I mean, they're pretty basic operation.
Yeah, but I mean, how many do you do? How many are done in a year? I mean, how, you know.
Well, you can't practice. I mean, you're saying you can't practice on the real deal, but you can practice like anyone practices to inject somebody with something or take blood.
Well, now you're talking about injection, but I'm talking about in general.
Okay.
It's a profession that one does not get to do a whole lot of practice on. The other thing I wanted to tell you was that as having my blood extracted myself for a to store it for surgery that I was going to have, they send you to a private laboratory, and they can extract the blood so that it can be stored in case you need it during surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one I went to, they stuck me 11 times, and they tried lying me down and sitting me up and changing my position and all kinds of things. And finally, they came to a conclusion that it just wasn't the fact that even though I have small veins, it wasn't just not being able to get in my vein. It was when they got in the vein rolls. And once the vein rolls, then they can't extract the blood, the serum from
okay.
it. And so, you know, there are lots of reasons that people are very... it's very difficult to get blood from certain people, and it has to be done certainly by an expert. And even then, it's difficult.
All righty. Thanks for calling, Lori.
You're
Maria, you're on the air. You want to talk about the drug that's used to paralyze the
condemned? Yes, I was under the impression that the first drug, the second drug that causes paralysis, I don't believe that has anything to do with pain, is my understanding. And I don't know the name of the drug. I assume it's succinylcholine. But my understanding is that it's to prevent excess movement or agonal gasping. And I'd like your some clarification on that, please.
Okay. Thanks, Maria. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm not going to put forth myself as an expert on that. She may well be right.
Okay. When is lethal injection used in every state now that has the death penalty?
I'm pretty sure every state now has lethal injection as an option, and a few states still also have something like the electric chair or hanging. But let's say For argument's sake, that lethal injection is the way we now put people to death in the United States for the most part.
It feels like we've had a spate of problems with it. It's just really been pretty recently.
We've had three situations in Ohio that have come up. 2006 was Joseph Clark, who we talked about, who was literally on the gurney, sat up. It wasn't working.
The drugs just didn't affect him.
That's right. And the needles weren't placed correctly. And that was you know, if that was a truly problematic execution in Ohio. The second case was 2007 with Christopher Newton, where it just took a long time because he was overweight and it was difficult to access his veins. That took quite a while. But that execution was carried out. The state does not consider that a botched execution. They say we did exactly what we're supposed to do. We took our time with an inmate whose veins were hard to find. We found them. We put them to death. Third case was Rommel Broom. Now, if you look nationally, there are numerous cases of problems with lethal injection all across the country. Some of them just as bad as Rommel Broom or worse. People whose the needle went through the vein and into the muscle, inmates who have an unusually strong reaction to the chemical and yell out in pain. Lots of places where the executions have been stopped, in fact, while they go in and figure out what the problem is. And this has happened, you know, throughout the modern history of lethal injection, certainly going back into the 1980s, where periodically you'll see these cases. So Ohio's not alone in this. The thing that's making this so distinctive is that not only do we stop an execution, it was postponed initially for a week when that was completely unprecedented, and now it's been postponed for a couple of months, and who knows. So I think we need to point that out. On the one hand, there have been some pretty awful cases of lethal injection problems that went horribly. On the other hand, we've executed, I don't know the exact number, but we're probably close to 1,100 to 1,200 people in the United States since 1972. And I think the majority of those did go at least as the prison system was hoping they would go. The needles were inserted, the chemicals went in, and the person died.
In 2006, after that one, the protocol changed, didn't it, a little bit?
That's right. They've a couple things have changed, and the new protocols were released in May. And the state had been doing some of this stuff for a while, and now they've just sort of written it down. But one of the things they changed after Clark in 2006 was that the execution team pretty much could take as much time as they wanted. There was a sense before that. And in fact, some of the execution team members have testified in court about this. There was a sense of, you know, there was sort of a clock ticking over their heads that they really had to get going and they had to kind of push themselves a little bit. And now they pretty much have as much time as they want. They take – if there's a problem, they stop. They can take a break. They say they're under no pressure to finish it in a certain time. So that's probably a pretty big change. And now when the inmate is on the gurney, once the initial sodium pentothal has been administered to put him to sleep, after about a minute or so, the warden will actually call out the inmate's name, push him a little bit, see if he'll respond. And that is to make sure that the first injection has actually worked, and then he gives another signal for the remaining two chemicals to be administered. And all that is to make sure that there's no situation as with the Clark situation.
How do we prepare the condemned? They're allowed to take muscle relaxants? Are they allowed to take sedatives? What options do they have to prepare physically and mentally today?
Well, it's a process that begins actually on death row in Youngstown, and they do have spiritual advisors, and they meet with those people. 72 hours before they're transported down to Lucasville, they're placed on a 24-hour watch where they're watched very closely. It's not quite a suicide watch. It's just to keep an eye on them to make sure that they're doing okay. Once they do come to Lucasville, the state will provide sedatives for them, and this is something that I've documented previously, not just in Ohio but in many states. Inmates will take a sedative just to calm them down, and sometimes they'll take a lot of them. There's nothing preventing that from happening. So they may have a sedative. They'll meet with spiritual advisors. The they'll call family members. Family members will visit. The day before an execution, they can have what are called contact visits, where they're sitting in a room with their loved ones. They can hug them, touch them, whatever. The morning of the execution, they're limited to visits at the cell. This is an extremely unusual process, as you can imagine, because on the one hand, in many cases, inmates are waiting to die. And in case of the volunteers that we've had in Ohio, they have no appeals left. They're simply watching the clock tick and waiting for the event. In other cases, even as they're meeting with their spiritual advisors and talking to their family and friends and even perhaps taking a sedative, they're also fighting in the courts up until the last minute. In fact, Rommel Broom's execution was delayed for 3 hours because he received an initial delay from the appeals court. And so his execution, which was supposed to start at 10, didn't start till 1:30 or so. And so you can see it's almost a paradox. They're preparing to die and in many cases fighting their execution right up to the last minute sometimes.
Wilfred Berry, who's known as the volunteer because he chose to forego the lengthy appeals process and be put to death immediately, he was afraid of needles. An emailer here from a listener says that they believe Ohio should bring in alternative methods. For example, they say, and I can't verify this, but Washington State has lethal injections and hanging, Utah lethal injections and the firing squad, Arizona lethal injections and gas to give people a choice. The worst thing I can tell my kid is it's time for the flu shot. That he considers cruel and unusual punishment. Doesn't bother me a bit. What about that, the choice issue?
Well, on Wilfred Berry, one thing he was also – he had a terrible breathing problem, and he was also very afraid of suffocating. And in fact, at one point had chosen the electric chair and eventually decided to go with lethal injection. You know, the choice is – it's a decision of the people in Ohio through their elected representatives. The state of Ohio has determined, lawmakers determined that the option that this state wants is lethal injection. We had the electric chair and injection for a little while, but there's been no use of the electric chair in Ohio since 1963. I really can't speak to whether Ohio should have another option. That would be something that the legislature would have to consider.
I'm sorry, I lost track of time. We're going to have to take a short break. I'm talking with author Andrew Welsh Huggins. He wrote what is considered the definitive book about the death penalty in Ohio, which is considered one of the busiest death penalty states in the country. I think it ranks about number four, right?
It varies from year to year, but it can be as high as two.
Okay. We're talking about not just the death penalty in Ohio, but more specifically the lethal injection process. What do you think? Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org and let us know. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I've got your picture that you gave to me.
Roseanne Cash was 18 when her father, Johnny Cash, wrote a list of songs he thought she should know. On the next Fresh Air, we hear some of those and talk with Roseanne Cash. Her new album is called The List. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich, 58 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1140. Get more radio. The WOSU Fall Membership Drive begins in just a few days, and we have only $11,000 left to raise before October 15th to get one pledge-free day during the drive. Get more programming and less fundraising. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree. to make your gift now, and thanks. WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Council on World Affairs present a keynote address by the President of Somalia, followed by an audience question and answer session, this Wednesday, October 8th, at 8:30 a.m. in the Terrace Ballroom of the Greater Columbus Convention Center. To register, visit columbusworldaffairs.org. Sunshine in the forecast for today, a high of 65, clear skies tonight, and a low of 45. Sunshine Tuesday morning and then a chance of afternoon rain on Tuesday. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us today is Associated Press reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins. He wrote the book No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Andrew Welsh Huggins also is an Associated Press reporter. That's how he kind of got onto the idea of the book in the first place. He found out that there really wasn't anything like this. There was no reference material to look back over the panorama of the death penalty in Ohio. We're talking about the lethal injection protocol today. Let us know what you think. Thumbs up, thumbs down on the lethal injection protocol. I know there's a lot of people out there who have strong feelings about whether the death penalty is right or not. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Andrew, we were talking about that the U.S. Supreme Court has actually ruled on the issue of lethal injection. Can you tell us what happened with that and how it affects these pending cases?
That's right. Well, it took a while, but the actual method of injection had never been its constitutionality was finally challenged. The actual merits of that procedure, and it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a case out of Kentucky, and the court did take the case. And during that period last year, the nation actually had sort of a de facto moratorium on executions. Nobody put anybody to death while the court was debating this. Now, the court did rule that lethal injection as a method of execution is constitutional, that it does not violate the Eighth Amendment. It's not cruel and unusual. Why is this important? Well, obviously, it's very important if you're a state carrying this out. But if you look at the case of Rommel Broom, this is going to be at the heart of his argument. Now, his attorneys can't necessarily say that they can't argue that injection is cruel and unusual. They have been attempting, and other attorneys in Ohio have been attempting to argue that Ohio's lethal injection procedure itself is unconstitutional. When the Supreme Court ruled in that case known as the Bays case, they did leave it up to states to determine what their policies were, and that they left the door open to challenges of states' policies, the way states actually carried out their own injection process. And that's still that's in the courts now. There's a trial coming up in November on the merits of that, and the Broom case will get wrapped up in that as well. But Broom's, you know, that's going to be at the heart of this issue. Can Broom argue that the way Ohio carries out its executions creates a cruel and unusual situation? And especially, can he argue that a second attempt for him only would violate his own rights against suffering cruel and unusual punishment? And that's going to be at the absolute heart of his argument and the state's opposing arguments.
How much does the mental anguish somebody goes through play into the cruel and unusual punishment issue? Is that really not at part of the issue, or is it strictly a physical?
That's a good question. I would imagine the arguments mainly focus on the physical pain that an inmate would suffer because of the process, and you can already see references to this in the depositions that Rommel Broom has given to being prodded or stuck 18 times. That he, at one point, apparently a needle went into his bone, and he screamed
that
because
would hurt.
It was so painful. So I think now that said, his attorneys have also made the point, I think a point well made immediately afterwards, that this was a person who was traumatized by what he went through. Now, whether there's a legal application of that trauma, that mental trauma, I think that's going to remain to be seen.
Okay, we'll give you some food. Brenda, I know you're pro-death penalty, but why don't you tell how you feel about the victims here in this case?
Well, I'm having a real hard time feeling sorry for these inmates, and I have a real issue with this interview, period. I mean, what about the victims of these heinous crimes inflicted on them by the inmates? What about their families who've had to live through the pain and agony of losing a loved one?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that really – I can't feel sorry for the guy.
Okay, Brenda. Thanks for your call, okay?
All right.
Yeah, that's probably something that there's that's an issue that doesn't really play into what happens in the courtroom on these cases, is it?
No, I don't think so. The situation we have here is that the state has determined, Ohio has determined that we shall have a death penalty law, that the ultimate punishment for the worst crime should be death. What's at issue here is how that's carried out, and the victims, the wishes of the victims are not considered under law in Ohio at this point. But the family members of victims witness these executions. I think that, they're provided a lot of information, and the fact of the matter is Ohio does carry out a lot of executions. So that people who, feel that victims have rights and that their wrongs should be addressed, you can look at the fact that Ohio has executed 32 people, and the pace is probably picking up in the state. I'm sure we're going to see more execution dates set relatively soon.
Okay, we have an email from a listener who wants to go back to the drug combination and explain something here. We can't verify any of this, but we'll say the paralyzing drug Pavilion is used to stop the breathing. It has nothing to do with less pain or less movement. The person is already unconscious by the sodium pentothal given first. The final drug, potassium chloride, stops the heart. So it's a three-part process.
Yeah, okay. I think that's right. Yeah. I would point out one of the issues that's been debated for a while is the initial sodium pentothal, which does put the inmates to sleep, is the drug that if anyone has ever had the unfortunate experience of putting a pet down, that's the only drug that's used. And there has been an argument made in other states, in other court battles, why don't we just use that drug? What's wrong with a massive dose of that drug?
Right.
And for whatever reason, the way these procedures have been developed state by state, they've wanted to go with this protocol. And I'm not that well versed in the history of that to explain why we just don't use a single dose of sodium pentothal, but that certainly has been argued in the past.
I was going to ask about that too. Now, until 2007, the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections kept their protocol secret. Was that right?
Yes, that is right. There was a lawsuit brought by a couple of inmates in Lorain County. These were people who were on trial. Their trials hadn't even started. They were defendants in death penalty cases, and they argued that the death penalty was unconstitutional, so they couldn't even be charged with the death penalty crime. And through the process of that case, a judge in Lorain County ordered the state to produce copies of its protocols, and that's when we got a look at the procedures. Some of the training that the team members go through, a little bit of the practice they do on mannequins, I think, how they practice for four times before an execution. So that's when we first get a good look. It's called the Rivera case. It really has had not much impact on cases around the state, but it did open up the procedures to us.
They ask for volunteers to do the procedure. How is it very common that people volunteer more than once, or is that frowned upon? What do you know about the sort of folks that volunteer?
It's common for someone. It's not frowned upon for someone to do it more than once. In fact, it's encouraged. We actually know quite a lot about the execution.
I guess the executioners.
The executioners, and the reason is that in March, Judge Frost, the federal judge in Columbus, held a hearing on this injection issue, and four members of the execution team testified anonymously. They were allowed to come into court. It was a very interesting visual sight. They would come into court, sit in a chair, and then a blackboard was placed in front of them. So people in the courtroom couldn't see them. At times, I'm not even sure some of the attorneys knew who they were. Anyway, we learned a great deal from their testimony. Team member 18, who retired in July, was the person who pressed the syringes. And by my count, he executed 29 of the 31 people that at that point had been executed. Wow. So he had been involved pretty much in every execution. He was a paramedic. He did have the skills. He testified that he agreed. He was asked to do it. He agreed to do it because he thought it should be done in a professional and a humane fashion. And there were times when there was a suggestion that maybe someone else should be given a chance to do it just to have a backup person, someone. He testified that other members of the execution team were not comfortable with that. They liked the fact that he was there, that he had the experience. And he continued to do it until he retired. There was a backup executioner who had done one previous execution. The state will not reveal any of these details, tell us who they are, who does what. But it's what we do know is that when team member 18 retired, he was replaced by another person who was a paramedic. And my sense is that the backup executioner became the person who presses the syringes. Now, I don't know that for sure, and the state isn't going to say.
When he retired, isn't that when some of these problems started to crop up or not?
No. Okay. He retired in end of June.
Okay.
And we certainly had one or two executions after he left before the broom case.
They're happening so frequently now, they don't pop up on the front page like they did.
We have one a month scheduled in Ohio and have had one a month scheduled in Ohio through February, including Broome and Lawrence Reynolds on Thursday. Of course, that's been stopped by the Sixth Circuit temporarily, but you know, you never know. The full Sixth Circuit could rule any minute and turn that around.
Texas is the number one in the country for executions.
That's right.
Pretty much all the way down the line, no one beats them.
No one's even close. They execute between 20 and 25 a year.
Which is about what we've done since 1999.
That's right.
Just about that.
Mm-hmm.
How do they execute? Is it – do they have a choice in Texas? Or?
There's no choice that I'm aware of. It's lethal injection. You can imagine they have it down to a science. And it takes place in Huntsville, I believe. And there have been problems with Texas executions, lethal injection problems, just like there have been problems elsewhere. Certainly nothing like the Broome case. No one in Texas that I've talked to recently since Broome has given any indication that's going to have any impact on how they do things. And essentially, they carry out their executions the way we do here in terms of how the needles are inserted and then the chemicals are run. They just do it a lot more frequently.
I'm talking with Andrew Welsh Huggins. He wrote No Winners Here, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. That's Ohio. And Andrew Welsh Huggins also is an Associated Press reporter and covers the death penalty issues pretty much routinely now, I guess. John, you're on the air. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi, John. You wanted to react to what Brenda had to say a little bit ago.
Yeah. She was talking about the victims, and I think her assumption is that these individuals are all guilty of their crimes. And with regard to Mr. Broome, in July, the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals ruled that his case should go back to the trial court because of the fact that the prosecutor had suppressed favorable evidence at the time of the trial, and that should be examined. So it's not always clear that the people involved are guilty of the crime at all, or if they're guilty, that they're guilty of what qualifies as a death offense, meaning that it's a murder with some kind of additional felony involved.
So you're saying, since we're not absolutely positive, the cruel and inhuman issue becomes more important.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, John. All right, take another call. Rod, you're on the air. Oh, he's not on the air. Okay, sorry about that. When does the state turn corners on the death penalty issue? What does it take to make changes? The New York Times, I guess over the weekend, wrote an editorial saying these botched, their word, not mine, these botched executions ought to be inspire the state to reconsider the death penalty in the first place. How do states work through these kind of processes? What's the chance of change?
Well, I think it's – my guess is it's a as society evolves, so evolves the state. Something that I often point out and my book points out is that in some ways Ohio and other states have made a change. People may not be aware of the fact that although we're executing a lot of people, these are cases that are sometimes 20 or more years old. Rommel Broome's case, keep in mind, that was a 1984 homicide that he was sentenced to die for. Ohio is sentencing virtually no one to death anymore. Juries are very reluctant to sentence people to death. Prosecutors are reluctant to bring it.
Has that been since we started up again in 99?
It began in 96 after we allowed a life in prison with no chance of parole, and it's only increased as other sentencing options have occurred. So while it's true that we still have a law that allows the state to execute people, the reality is we put very few people on death row anymore, perhaps 3 to 4 a year tops. And I think I certainly don't see anything that's going to change that down the road. Economically, it's very tough for prosecutors to bring a death penalty case. We do have provisions now in Ohio that allow people who commit the worst crimes to, if they're convicted, spend the rest of their life in prison. And I would also say, based on my own reporting, there are numerous family members of murder victims out there who, frankly, really don't want the death penalty. It's not that they don't want justice, but given the choice between a closure to this awful crime and the long, drawn-out appeal process that is involved in a death penalty case, a lot of them would just as well see the person spend the rest of their life in prison.
So as a form of punishment, not as a form of reprieve, see it as more of a punishment.
And that's certainly – there's plenty of people who do see life in prison as a far worse punishment than an actual execution. So I think in terms of how society changes, a state makes a change on the death penalty, I would argue that the state of Ohio and other states have already made that change, and you can see it reflected in the diminishing number of death sentences as well as indictments, just charges that would carry a death penalty. All that's on the decline.
What's the last state to abolish the death penalty in recent history?
That would be New Mexico. Okay. And that was – if I have the order right, New Mexico, and just previous to that was New Jersey. So we're down to we now have 36 death penalty states. Now, many of the 36 are not what we would consider active. They do have a death penalty law. Kansas, I think, would be a good example of a state with a death penalty law, but it's been a while since they've actually executed anyone.
Okay. We're out of time. This is a very multifaceted topic. My thanks to all the listeners for focusing in on the lethal injection aspect of it. My thanks also to Associated Press reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins. He's the author of No Winners Here, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Morpsey's Ride Solutions, a source for carpooling, vanpooling, busing, biking, and walking in Central Ohio. Morpsey, find a better way to work. More information at ridesolutions@morpsey.org.